This is Mike Smith interviewing Alan Reuther at the UAW Washington, D.C. office on May 7th, 2010. So, Alan, I guess this was the way I start just about every oral history interview. Let's start at the beginning. When were you born and where were you raised?
I was born September 26, 1949, in Detroit, Michigan. And my parents were Roy and Fania Reuther, and grew up in the suburbs of Detroit, Michigan.
May I ask which particular city?
The mailing address was Orchard Lake. The school district was Bloomfield Hills. And actually, my parents looked for exactly that situation because they wanted us to get a very good education, but politically they didn't want the mailing address to be Bloomfield Hills. So. But it actually, I mean, several things. That's actually the house we lived in from when I was 10 on. Before that, we lived at a house in Birmingham. It's actually a small carriage house, but my early years, until I was growing up, until I was 10, our house was very isolated. There were only a few other houses within walking distance, and partly I think that was done for security reasons. When I was born, Walter and Victor had just been shot, and so at that time my dad, you know, had a bodyguard. There was a dog pen that went around three sides of the house. We had a German Shepherd dog that was not a pet. You know, the front door was this thick and had bulletproof glass in the center. And the thing my brother and I remember, I had an older brother who was 3 years older.
And what was his name?
David. And growing up in that house, there were Venetian blinds made out of metal. There were bulletproof Venetian blinds. And we both grew up thinking that all Venetian blinds were like that. We didn't realize that that was unusual. But and, I mean, as a kid, I was oblivious to what was going on, but it was a very isolating existence. And as I said, there was only a couple other houses within walking distance. You know, I grew up with my brother being my primary playmate, and grew up with the couple other kids in the area were my brother's age, so I sort of grew up competing against older kids that way.
How long did you, I'm curious about the bodyguard, not that this is a major influence on your life, I'm sure, but how old were you when you recognized that there was this person hanging out with your dad, and how long did your dad have a bodyguard?
He kept the bodyguard until we moved into our new house in, I think, 1960, and at that point he decided that enough time had passed, and he was tired of living that way, and the house we moved into in Orchard Lake didn't have all that security, and he stopped having a bodyguard. But it, you know, I think from the time I was five, I at that point I had heard the stories about the shooting and all that, and so I realized it was a bodyguard. But I also vividly remember it. You know, for a young kid, it's like cops and robbers. And, I mean, my dad was very close, obviously, with Walter and Victor, and many, many evenings would drive out to Walter's place, you know. And when I was five, I'd see Walter, I would go bang, 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 and pretend like I was shooting him. And, you know, now I think about Jesus Christ. But for a little kid, that's, you know. So that was my sense of it at the time. I don't think I really appreciated what was going on.
But was it a bodyguard 24 hours a day?
No, I think he you know, left in the evening but would come and pick up my father and then would be with him throughout the workday. I think the sense was probably, you know, once he got home and was inside sort of this fortress that...
Yeah, right, your bulletproof Venetian blinds. That is an experience that most of us, you know, couldn't relate to, you know.
The other thing about growing up, after we moved to Orchard Lake, we were in a very conservative area. I mean, I remember in high school, out of a class of 350 kids, there were maybe three Democrats. So I sort of grew up with a very skewed view of, you know, most of the world. I mean, these were mostly kids whose parents worked in, for the auto companies or related things. And I had lots of friends and all that. I was elected senior class president, and you know, I didn't have problems as a result of that, but it was just a very different environment.
I would think so. Of course, there are legendary stories about your dad and his brothers, mm-hmm. and the way they grew up. For example, there was the famous story that they would practice speeches for after their Sunday dinner. That your grandfather Valentine Ruther, who was an uneducated, or I should say self-educated man, insisted that they know the issues of the day and that they would practice their speeches because Valentine Ruther would ask them to debate points after the dishes were cleared after Sunday dinner. Did you have any kind of similar experience?
No, there wasn't that type of formal thing. I think we did have the experience, as I said, of often going out and being with Walter and his family, and then there was also lots of family trips to go see my grandparents in Wheeling. And growing up, again, as a little kid, I vividly remember my grandfather telling the stories, particular about the story about him seeing children going into the mines and then bringing the bodies of the dead children out and going before the legislature in West Virginia to argue for a child labor law, and telling the legislature there'll be blood on your hands if you don't do it. And so I think I absorbed a lot of the background from visits with the grandparents and being around Walter and Victor a lot. Take trips to Washington and be with Victor. But it wasn't the formal thing with my dad of, okay, stand up and do debates. Part of it was my dad traveled a lot. And in fact, I have this memory. I don't know if this is true, but memory of one year my dad, I guess, looking over the records at tax time or whatever and realizing he had been traveling 250 days out of the year.
Mm.
I'm sure that had a tremendous impact on my mother, but I actually didn't have the experience of, oh, my dad's going to be at home at night. And I actually, growing up, probably had a lot more, well, it was my mother who helped me with studies all the time, not my dad.
Mm-hmm.
So,
what was the expectation regarding studies from your parents? Regarding your studies and their expectations?
I think early on, the type of kid I was, I was a good student, always getting things completed, so they didn't have to be on me on the studies. I think from early on, like Spanish, I would take flashcards and, have my mother quiz me. And I remember preparing for exams in high school, I'd study my notes and then I'd give them to my mother and I'd recite them back to her. And so, but it was very much my mother being the hands-on person because my dad was gone so much. And I think partly was, I think the central influence for me growing up was being competitive with my older brother. And so I think my being sort of the good child and doing well in school was partly how I was being competitive.
Mm-hmm.
I think I mentioned before, my brother was my primary playmate, and mm-hmm. We had a ping pong table in the basement, and we had lots of ping pong games and battles. And one side of our rec room, this was in the new house after I was 10, it was sliding glass doors. And if I beat my brother in ping pong, he would throw his paddle at me. And so I'd have this tension of, if I dodge the paddle, it's going to hit the window and break. So I actually learned after I hit the winning shot to run out of the room before he could throw his paddle at me. But, I mean, my brother and I had a close relationship, but it was competitive.
Yeah, sure.
And,
sure.
My brother went to the University of Michigan, and I followed in his footsteps in high school. I took a bunch of the classes that he took. At one point, I did the debate club because he had done it, so... he was certainly a huge influence.
What did your brother do for a career?
He went on to be an editor, publisher of children's books, very successful. But
he didn't go the labor union route.
He did not.
Yeah. You know, you come from a famous labor family, so that's well established. So what I'd like to do is actually ask you about some individual characters and maybe end up with your dad. But let's start with your mom. Could you tell me a bit about your mother? Your relation, I don't mean to ask intimate questions, but her role with her dad, with your dad, maybe her role with labor, whatever you think would be useful. For historians to know.
Mother and father met at the Brookwood Labor College, I think in the early 30s. And then my mother was part of the Women's Brigade in Flint, Michigan, and actually got arrested. And my mother was born in Russia, in a small village near Minsk, and lived through pogroms. Couple of her oldest brothers escaped from Russia to avoid having to serve in the Tsar's army and made their way to this country. And then the father died, and the rest of the family came over. My mother came through Ellis Island. They arrived the day Harding died, so Ellis Island got shut down, and they had to spend an extra day. But she grew up.
What year was that? I don't recall when Harding died.
I think like 1914, something like
that. And how old was she?
I think she was 9 when they left Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And she was, I think, the youngest child in her family.
Mm-hmm.
She grew up in the Cleveland area and got involved with a young socialist and went to Brookwood Labor College. But during the Flint sit-down strike, she got thrown in jail with a bunch of the other folks. And I remember her talking about how she was worried they were going to deport her, but it didn't happen. The funny thing is, my brother and I had always thought, well, okay, this is how my parents met, and they got married, and we knew they didn't get married till right after or towards the end of World War II, 1945. What was not told to my brother and I until my brother actually had been married and was getting divorced, learned that my mother had actually been married to someone else, a person named High Fish.
Oh, sure.
And and during the Flint sit-down strikes, apparently there was a group house that a whole bunch of folks lived in. My mother, High Fish, and my dad was also rooming there. So it really makes me wonder what the dynamics was. But
because to be sure, They met at Brookwood, so this is prior to the Flint sit-down.
Yes, and High Fish was at Brookwood.
Right.
And my mother married him, and then sometime after Flint, and, I don't know, late 30s, early 40s, my mother got divorced from High Fish, and then eventually got married to my father. It always surprised my brother and I that, we never learned growing up that this had happened. But
when I was writing a biography, not to digress from your oral history, writing a biography of Leonard Woodcock, I found out that there was an early wife that no one knew about. It happens.
Anyways, the my parents got married, as I said, right at the end of the war, and I think my mother was older then, and so it was, let's have kids, like everyone did right after World War II. And so then, the other interesting family story, my mother came from a Jewish family, and the story we were told growing up was that my father offered to convert, and everyone said, oh, you're so much of a mensch, and it's not necessary. And the truth of it was, my mother's mother was very old at that time, and they just didn't tell her that she was marrying a non-Jew. And eventually she passed away. But anyways, my brother, I guess, was born in 46, and I was born in 49. I was 6 weeks premature. And I think I was, about 3.5 pounds, and spent the first 6 weeks of my life in an incubator. So, but my mother stayed home after we were born, as was the norm at the time. I've always thought, that had a huge impact on her, because even though she didn't have a lot of formal education, she was pretty sharp. Mm-hmm. And, she wound up, first of all, very isolated the first 10 years of her life in a small house in Birmingham. But even after we moved to Orchard Lake, as I said, the community we were living in was very conservative. There were no other Jewish families, no other labor families. I just think it was probably very, very isolating for her, and I think she was probably frustrated that she didn't have a job, but she lived her life through my father. It was all about the union, and I often tell people, my brother and I didn't grow up with any religious training. We didn't go to church. We didn't go to synagogue. In place of that for us was the UAW. That was our religion growing up. Just constantly talking about the labor movement, about politics especially, because that's the area that my dad wound up in. And my mother, was totally involved in that and talking about it, but not doing it herself anymore, but living it through my father.
She really wasn't active at all?
No.
Did she go to events with your father? And
yes,
sort of a,
some.
UAW wife, if
yes.
You'll permit.
Yes.
But yet, you did grow up in an environment where issues were talked about at the table, or your mom and dad would talk politics with the children.
Yeah, all the time. And in fact, I remember in early grade school, we'd do papers, and they'd just be spouting sort of the Democratic line, why Stevenson was good and Eisenhower was bad. Yeah, we absorbed all of that. And I think the other thing, maybe just a flag that I've always thought was important for me, of the four Reuther brothers, I was the youngest of all of their children.
Mm.
And and I'm the only one who went on to work for the UAW. And I've always thought that there was some relationship there. But I think I grew up of, you know, seeing Walter, Victor, my dad, these powerful men, and them always talking about the exciting things. I mean, going out to Walter's house and hearing him talk about the latest stories of, you know, meeting with the president or meeting with civil rights leaders or international labor leaders. And, you know, it just always seemed so exciting to me that I think that was the attraction to me. What else could you possibly want to do? It's, you know, just the most exciting, best thing in the world. I sometimes analogize it to a kid whose father is the priest or minister, and, you know, the thing about Walter especially was, I think part of his power was, he was always so convinced of the righteousness of what he was doing and his point of view. And so there's this sort of moral authority of, it wasn't just, well, I'm doing this or that. It's, you know, this is the right path. This is social justice. This is, and my dad had the same beliefs, but it wasn't the same sense of total certitude that everything you're doing is 100% right, seeing more both sides of things. Walter was so charismatic, Victor too, although in a different arena. And I think it was just very, very attractive to me, and everything seemed so exciting about what they were involved in and having the ability to influence what was happening in the world. And I think that's what drew me into wanting to follow in their footsteps.
When did you decide you did want to follow in their footsteps?
The growing up, my brother and I often talked about what we call the Debs-Joyce paradox, and that we thought there were only two possible paths in life. One was to be like Eugene Victor Debs, and, you know, you become a labor leader / politician and, you know, fight these noble causes, usually losing, but, or, you know, getting put in jail or suffering because of that, but doing the good fight. The other path was to be like James Joyce, and you go into exile and you write the great American novel. And after I'd graduated from college, I had 3 years off in between college and law school, and the last year of that I spent a year over in Belgium working for the Belgian metalworkers. And it was sort of my effort to, okay, I'm going to go to Europe and I'm going to be a writer. It was really why I was going. But I was too scared to just go over there without a job, and through Victor I got this internship with the Belgian metalworkers. And anyways, while I was over there, I learned that if you're going to be a writer, that involves being by yourself trying to write, and I didn't like that. My personality was, I always much rather be having interactions with people. And so I came back from that and decided to go to law school. But I knew from the beginning I didn't want to go out and practice corporate law. I wanted to be a labor lawyer. I also made a decision that for a while I thought about, well, should I go into the plant and get seniority and try and have a political future in the union? And I ultimately decided against that because I thought, well, then I'll always be measuring myself against my dad and against Walter, and I thought that's not a good thing. I thought it was sort of different enough if I came in as a lawyer. I thought, well, I'll still be doing good by working for the union, but it'll be my own career. The other thing.
Excuse me, but I find that very interesting. Sorry to interrupt.
No.
That you're actually, at this point, consciously making decisions in regards to not only your personal desires, but your family's influence and the reality of politics on the ground in the UAW, that even if you're an educated person, and tell me if I'm wrong, you go into the plants because you make your bones a certain way for a certain career. Do I have that sort of accurate?
Well, the rule in the UAW was to have a political career, you had to have seniority in the plant. Now, there were a number of examples of people just going in the plant for 90 days and then being put on staff. But you had to do that at a minimum. You couldn't come in as a lawyer and have a political career. And so, and I talked to Herb Bluestone, I talked to Ken Morris, and, you know, I had the option of going the route of trying to go in the plant, and then thinking about it, I thought, for the reason I said, that it just seemed like not having my own life then. It would have been always trying to replicate what Walter did and what my dad did. When I was in law school, I should back up. For a while, I thought about, should I get a job with the union and go to law school at night? And I actually had an offer from AFSCME. This is when Jerry Wirth was running AFSCME to do that, to be an assistant to him. And then I would have gone to law school at night. Then I thought about it, and what a long, hard slog that would have been, and opted not to do that. Probably would have gotten fired by Jerry Wirth like everyone else. So it was probably a good thing. But when I was in law school, the first summer I did an internship at the UAW and liked it. Second summer I interned for a labor firm out in Los Angeles, Abe Levy's firm. Abe Levy had been an old friend of my parents. In fact, he was at their wedding. I love California, but I realized I like working for the union directly rather than being in a private firm. Comes near graduation, and I check back with the UAW, and the general counsel at the time, John Fillion, said, you know, we'd love to have you. I had done good work for them, and I had great grades in law school and all that, but he said, we have no openings. Sorry. And so I started checking around at other labor opportunities, and the law firm that did AFSCME's work was run by Abe Swerdling, who's also an old friend of the family. And so I reached out to him, and after some time, I got a call saying, come to Washington, so we can talk. So it was clearly there was a job there for me. And I said, this was right before Christmas. I said, I'll be there anyways for our holidays in a couple weeks. Why don't I see you then? Great. Then a little bit after that, I get a call back from John Fillion saying, turns out there is an opening and we're willing to take you on staff. And I said, that's great. Not sure what I want to do. I have this other offer, I think. And in my own mind at the time, I was thinking, maybe it's better to go work for the Swerdling firm and ask me, because again, I won't be just doing the UAW. It'll be my own labor path. So I show up at Swerdling's office over the Christmas holidays, and he says, sorry, we don't have anything. And I'm going, why did you ask me to come here? But I didn't have the guts to ask him that directly. So I went to work for the UAW. years later, run into Zwerdling, I think at the UAW convention, and I ask him finally what happened. And he says, well, what happened between the first time I talked to you and the second time? And it was the UAW had made an offer, and I'm sure what happened is when I told Fillion that I had this other offer from AFSCME, somebody from the UAW got on the horn and said, you better withdraw that offer. So, you know, looking back, I don't regret a minute having gone to work for the UAW, but it is sort of ironic that my life direction was being influenced by other people deciding where I ought to go.
So it wasn't inevitable that you would go to the UAW. No. You just knew that labor law was your passion. Yeah. Before we go too much farther, I want to step back on a couple things. But if we can stay on this train, what was your undergraduate degree?
History.
History. At the University of Michigan.
Yes. And Sidney Fine was sort of the main professor. And I did my senior thesis on the reaction of blacks to Roosevelt and the New Deal.
Oh, really?
and I got to interview Roy Wilkins and Robert Weaver. Anyways, I enjoyed history. I thought one path might have been going on to try and get a PhD in history, but I decided on law school.
And then there was a 3-year hiatus, yes, as you mentioned. So you mentioned the Belgian metal workers. That was for a year or so?
Yeah.
So what did you do the 2 years before that?
I was a conscientious objector during the Vietnam War, and I did alternative service. My brother had been a conscientious...
Were you drafted then?
Yes.
Yes.
The whole story is you apply for alternative service, and then you're drafted like anyone else, and then they assign you to do alternative service. And at the time I did it, what they were doing is routinely denying everyone, making you come in for an interview. And I vividly remember going to that interview. And everything was so unfair because it just depended on your local people and whatever. But I'd filed for the status before my lottery number came up, and I think that influenced them. I think the fact that my brother had been the CO before me influence them, but anyways, they gave me the status. I worked, I think, for about 3 months for a hospital in Boston, and the rule was that they let you find an acceptable job, save the draft board the trouble, but it had to be like a hospital or a nonprofit, and had to be away from home. Anyways, after about 3 months, I transferred down to Washington, D.C., and worked at a place called International Student House, which is on 18th and R, basically, and doing janitorial clerical work for them. But that's partly where I also got the desire to eventually go over to Belgium, because I saw the foreign students living here, and I really wanted to get the experience myself of actually living in another country, as opposed to just going over for a summer, European tour type thing. After I'd been working there, a year and a half, one day in the mail, I got a notice that there had been a court case that had been brought by the ACLU, unbeknownst to me, saying that they had illegally drafted about 2,000 COs. This was the time when Nixon was calling a moratorium in the draft to diffuse political pressure, but they didn't stop also calling COs, and I happened to just fall in one of those things. So the notice from the draft board said, the court says you don't have to serve anymore. So that's what ended my service, although I kept working at the student house till the end of the year until the Belgian thing got lined up.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Then back from Belgium, was there any notable activities or influences or just events while you were in Belgium that maybe shaped some of your future thinking?
Well, yeah, I it was a profound experience to live there. One thing, I had only studied French for a very short time. Actually, in school, I'd always done Spanish, and so I took 1 year of French before I went over. Anyways, I was a very weak French speaker, and so I had the experience of what it's like to be in a country where you really can't speak and can't communicate that well. Now, by the end of the year, I was pretty good, but I think it's given me more empathy for immigrants in this country now, and just what it's like when people perceive you as not being fluent in the language. It was also just interesting to see the differences in the labor movement and sort of realizing that the way things that are done in the U.S. aren't necessarily the way they're done in other countries. And good and bad. It also, I saw the Belgian unions' hostility, for example, to Caterpillar, who they were having a dispute with. And feeling that, but also at the same time, it was a time when there was great unemployment in the U.S., and sort of feeling like, well, if you don't want the jobs, we could sure use them back in the United States. So I remember that tug of war sort of with my own feelings. I've always felt very good about having that experience. Just sort of giving me a broader perspective on mm-hmm. both the labor movement and the world generally. Mm-hmm.
And then you go to law school in
74 to 77.
Seven. And then it's into the UAW.
Graduated from law school, I guess on a Saturday morning, and flew off to a convention. And I guess Long Beach or wherever it was that year started that day.
And you graduated magna cum laude, I might add, and had, it looks like, let's see, note and comment editor for the Journal of Law Reform.
As an editor, I think that year, the journal had three articles on labor law issues, one I wrote and two that I had people I was overseeing, right? So I'm sure people thought, gosh, there's an awful strong emphasis on labor topics.
Yeah. Well, before we get into, specifics of your career in the, in the UAW, I really want to sort of step back to family life. You come from a highly influential family. We talked about your mother a bit. Maybe before we talk about your father, tell me about his brothers that you knew well. You spent a lot of time with these folks, and they had some influence on them. Why don't you let's start with Victor Reuther, perhaps?
Well, Victor was always sort of the more exotic brother because he had lived in Europe and. He drank wine, which Walter and Roy almost never drank. And Victor was just much more cosmopolitan is the right word, but it when we'd come on vacations to Washington and get to listen to Victor talk about all the international people he was in contact with, and talking about the British trade unionists or their trip to India, and that again it was opening my eyes to how big the world was, and again it always seemed so exciting. Also, I often thought Victor was maybe the best speaker of all three brothers. I mean, he had this ability to let his emotions come through. I mean, even in later years, it's his ability to go up and down. And it wasn't just a harangue when he would speak. It would be very well modulated of, you know, great emotion and intensity and then dropping back. And I guess I was always a bit in awe of his ability that way. But it... one other, actually, memory I have of Victor. When I was at the student house, they used to have programs, various speakers, people from embassies, some State Department officials. And so one time I invited Victor to come, and he comes into the hall, and he goes around and he works the audience before, you know, introducing himself to all these students from different countries, and he was able to, you know, speak a word or two of their languages. And you know, most speakers would just come in and be behind the podium, and so he wowed everyone that way. And and then in his talks, you know, most of the speakers, as I said, would be sort of State Department line, and here was Victor with a very much more progressive line. But pro-American, I remember one of the questions was, you know, critical of America, and he took issue with the questioner. So it, but I was very, very proud of just how he related to all the foreign students. And then I remember, you know, it was over, and I walked him out, and he was just walking down the street by himself, and, you know, no entourage or anything. And the other story, the jumping ahead many years, let's see when this had been. It must have been 1970. This is when I was in college. I did an internship for Senator Gaylord Nelson. And so I stayed with Victor and Sophie that summer. And so I was at their house the night the call came about Walter and May's plane going down. Mm. And that was the same day as the big demonstrations over Nixon's invasion of Cambodia. And Victor and Sophie and I and others had been out at the demonstration during the day. In fact, I remember being with Victor as he tried to get behind the podium to ask them to let him read a statement because the UAW executive board had finally broken with the war and issued a statement condemning the invasion. But we didn't have the right connections, and they didn't let Victor speak. But anyways, we went back to the house at night, and we were expecting some of the demonstrators to come and, you know, bunk on the floors in his house. And 10:30, 11, whenever it was, I hear the shouting upstairs, and figured it was just Victor and Sophie fighting, as they often did. And then Victor coming down to tell me they'd gotten a call from a reporter about the plane crash. And I just remember it was like, oh my God, the world just changed. And how devastated Victor was.
Mm-hmm. The brothers, you know, from the outside, it appeared that they had a close relationship. And I can tell you from, you know, reviewing the records that they sure did a lot of activities together living in Detroit, especially Victor and Walter. Your dad went to Brookwood and chose to stay behind. Victor and Walter went on
right.
The huge 3-year sojourn in Europe. But, you know, it seems like they had a very caring relationship, even if there were intellectual disagreements. Is that fair?
Absolutely. And I mean, I talked before about the sort of our religion was the UAW, and my wife, my mother being living her whole life through the Union. And maybe it was because they were the union was so under attack and assault in the early years that I think it made the whole UAW community just, they did things together. I mean, our family's best friends were the Bluestones. Mm-hmm. And we would go to the Bluestones to celebrate Passover, and the Bluestones would come to our house to trim our Christmas tree. And, you know, that Bluestones and Nat Weinberg were sort of the people that my parents socialized with, and then going to see Walter and Victor. So it was a small, tightly knit group.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Before we go to Walter, since you brought up Irv, you know, maybe we could speak about that. Or tell me your opinions and interactions with Irv Bluestone.
Well, when I was growing up, Irv was the chief of staff to Walter. And, you know, he had this beautiful voice. It's just, you always love listening to him because he sounded so wise, and was such a warm individual. I mean, the one event that, and I know this has been written about in books, was the famous Passover dinner where his son Barry and Leslie Woodcock confronted and engaged in a debate with Walter and the rest of them over the Vietnam War, which, I mean, as I said, we went to the Bluestones for Passover every year, and some of the years then Walter would come with his wife, and Barry was at the University of Michigan at the time, and one of the involved in SDS, and he was also involved with Leslie Woodcock at the time. So it sort of shows how closely intertwined. But and the Passovers were always sort of about social justice. I mean, there's a part in the Passover service where there's a story about how the Pharaoh would have the Israelites build, you know, bricks, and they would work really hard, and then the Pharaoh would say, okay, you have to build that many bricks every day. And at that point, you know, Irv would mumble about Ford Speed Up, and Walter would say, yeah, the Russian version of that they had experienced. And, you know, we thought that was part of the text of the Passover service. They sort of turned it into, it's all about labor struggles. And so this particular Passover, at the beginning, Barry and Leslie say, well, do you mind if we read a poem? And the poem was an anti-war poem. And that started into, as I remember, an hour-long debate about the Vietnam War, with Barry and Leslie pleading with Walter to, you know, break with Johnson and come out against the war, and which he wouldn't do. Well, Johnson's working on it. He's gonna bring it to an end. And plus, you know, to Walter, LBJ's Great Society was sort of the dream come true of everything they were accomplishing. And but at, you know, I'm in high school, and I'm just in awe that, you know, Barry's taking on Walter. And, you know, he's taking on Walter, my dad, and his own dad, and going toe-to-toe with them. And I just was, oh, my God, how can you do this? Yeah. And I also often think of poor Zelda sitting there, her, you know, holiday dinner being taken over with this Zelda debate with her son challenging her husband's boss.
Yeah.
But... but I think it also does illustrate, again, how tightly knit the community was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, speak a bit about Walter Reuther. I mean, in labor history, he's one of just, you know, four or five labor leaders who were highly influential. One could argue he was the most influential labor leader in history, considering his social agenda. Vietnam War aside, perhaps you could speak about having such a famous uncle.
Well, I think I've talked before about going out to their house quite often, and listening to the stories that he would tell. And Walter would always, you know, sort of like the conductor of the evening.
Is he clearly the leader?
Yes. I mean, he had to be leading. And that's sort of good and bad. I mean, as a kid, you know, I was in awe of these great stories, and it was all so exciting. But I do think it took the oxygen out of the room for anyone else, because it was all about the union and all about what Walter was doing. But, you know, things that have been written are true about that there was this view that it wasn't just about negotiation, there was a social movement, and it was about advancing social justice for everyone, and the labor movement was an instrument for doing that. And I was totally enthralled by it, as mm-hmm. I said.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's speak a bit, if you don't mind, about your father. The standard, I guess, interpretation is that your father was a bright man, committed unionist, and sort of the kinder Reuther who was in the background and who could smooth over some of the conflicts that arose. Anyway, if you would, I'd really appreciate it if you'd give us a rendition of your father and then perhaps his influence on you.
I think that general description is correct, that he was the warmer personality. In the family gatherings, he would be one to, you know, make self-deprecating jokes about himself. And he was also more concerned about, I think, other people, whereas Walter had to be the center of attention. My dad didn't have to be. But I remember with the Bluestone family, for example, when we were very little, the younger daughter was not as pretty as their older daughter. And my dad went out of his way to pay special attention to the younger daughter just because he realized she needed more attention. Or I have this other memory of coming back with my mom and dad from the airport one day, and we wound up sharing a cab with someone else, and it turned out to be a person who had his throat cancer and had the operation, and so that speaking through whatever it was, but it basically, when they would speak, it sounded like they were throwing up, and then mm-hmm. it was just, and my dad talked to him the whole ride back, mm-hmm. and after we left, my dad said, well, I kept talking because I didn't want him to feel bad about, you know, that no one wanted to talk with him. It was sort of my dad's personality of wanting other people to feel comfortable. My dad's area of was the political area. I guess nowadays we would talk about him as the political director. I mean, he oversaw the Washington office, but it was the political end as opposed to the lobbying end that he did.
Maybe you could explain the difference at this point.
Well, the lobbying end would be actually going up to the Hill, talking with members of Congress to advance a bill this way or that way. I think on major issues my dad would do that, but I think he was much more the guy in charge of the overall political effort to get members of Congress elected. And of course, people knowing his close relationship with Walter, that gave him added influence. I guess one of my earliest memories was at the Democratic Convention in 1960, being there at the convention in the stands, watching it. And we had sort of planned a family vacation coming back, but my dad got asked by Kennedy's to head up voter registration effort. He wasn't the name head. I think there was Congressman Frank Thompson, but he was the guy behind Thompson who was really doing the work. And my dad's contribution was to focus registration efforts in African-American districts, and which turned out to be crucial in Illinois and other states. Nowadays, that's thought of as, well, of course, that's routine now. But back then, that was a new strategy that folks hadn't thought about. My dad went on. He got later appointed by Kennedy to a commission that looked at the whole registration voting situation and made a bunch of recommendations. But that was always a passion in his life. Mm-hmm. A couple stories he always used to tell. He was involved over the years in civil rights struggles a lot. In fact, Walter didn't like to go to funerals, and he often had my dad attend funerals for him. And I remember my dad coming back from the Medgar Evers funeral and talking about white crowds spitting at him. He was even worse. He was a traitor that he was down there showing support. Another story told, which must have been 57 or 58, when they're trying to get civil rights legislation through, and Southern senators are blocking it, including LBJ, and my dad ran into Bobby Baker, LBJ's right-hand guy, off the Senate floor, and they basically got into a nasty dispute, and I think some harsh words were spoken. By the time my dad got back to Detroit, Meany, Dubinsky, and I think LBJ had all called Walter demanding that he fire my dad.
Oh, really?
For having gotten into this fight with Bobby Baker. So my dad said he walked into Walter's office, and Walter said, "You've been busy." He told what had happened, and Walter said, "Oh, that's okay."
So your dad wasn't above losing his temper once in a while?
Apparently not. The conversation with Bobby Baker was, Baker said, "Oh, we're a broad party. We have a lot of different views." And my dad said, "Then why are you twisting arms to get our people, off of their positions?" I guess it degenerated from there. But then the other story is the signing of the Civil Rights Bill. LBJ was there with all the pens lined up in front of him. And when he finished signing, everyone rushed up, except Bobby Kennedy remained seated because it wasn't that long after the assassination. He was still depressed. And the story, as my dad told it, was Sorensen came over to my dad and said, "This isn't right. Bobby's not going to get any pens. Why don't you take him up there?" My dad said, "Why me?" But he then proceeded to take Bobby Kennedy by the arm and basically dragged him up. And Bobby Kennedy's going, "No, Roy, no." And my dad's going, "Make way, the Attorney General," and dragged him up right behind LBJ. And LBJ, gives Kennedy one and a bunch of pens for his assistants. And then he said, "Anyone else?" And Bobby Kennedy says, "Mrs. Kennedy," meaning Jacqueline. And LBJ gives him a bunch more. And anyways, after that, of course, my dad stepped in and got a pen for himself, and one of my prized possessions is the pen there. So, another story I remember a lot with my dad was relates to the whole farm worker thing. I think he was the first national labor leader to go out to Delano to support the farm workers in the Great Boycott. I know you've probably seen the pictures later of me and Walter dedicating the hall there to my dad. But besides that, my dad also got involved with the farm worker struggles in Texas. I think it was in the last year of my dad's life. and apparently one of the farm workers there had been killed by the Texas Rangers, and mm-hmm. my dad